And welcome once again to the Ultimate Men's Summit. This is Lion Goodman, your co-host, and I am very, very pleased to be here with Bill Plotkin, the author of two amazing books, one called Soulcraft, Crossing into the Mysteries of Nature and Psyche, and Nature and the Human Soul, Cultivating Wholeness and Community in a Fragmented World. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Lion. It's a pleasure.
I have a little story to tell you about Bill and I. I was a undergraduate student at the University of Colorado and doing weird things with drugs and consciousness, and I ran into this guy who had a beard and long hair, and he was a graduate student, and he told me about this amazing professor in the psychology department who I began studying with, Peter Osorio, and Peter became one of my thesis advisors for my bachelor's degree in consciousness, and Bill and I sort of drifted apart, but we did become friends at that time, and 40 years later we re-meet, so it's amazing to re-meet you, Bill.
Same, Lion. It's delightful. Yes, recognized you immediately when you walked into Pachamama restaurant there in San Francisco a few months ago.
So Bill's doctorate is in psychology. He went way beyond the degree I did, but University of Colorado doctorate. He's the founder of Colorado's Animus Valley Institute, which he founded in 1981, which is a soul guidance organization that takes men and women into nature-based initiatory passages. And they've taken thousands of people through their programs and transformed many, many lives. Prior to that, he was a research psychologist studying non-ordinary states of consciousness, my personal favorites, and was a professor of psychology and a psychotherapist and even a rock musician and, you know, Whitewater River guide. So he got called by nature. Nature called him to its bosom, and he followed the call, and he has come up with some really amazing descriptions of what it means to be a mature person in our society, why our society looks and acts so immature, and our topic today is nature-based soul initiation from adolescence to mature masculinity. So let's dive right in, Bill. How is true adulthood reached? What does that mean, true adulthood, and what does it look like?
Great, that is a good way to dive in. And so let me say to our listeners right off the top here that my view, my understanding of mature psychological maturity, what it means to be a true adult, is something that we don't find anywhere in mainstream Western society. You know, we've lost it. But I didn't make it up. We find it in healthy traditions from other cultures all over the world. We find it in mythology. Find it in depth psychology, as in Carl Jung and his students. We find it in contemporary poetry in many places. So, but I've been working on articulating this for about 30 years. So my understanding of what it means to be a true adult is to have discovered one's identity, one's place in the world, in terms of the Earth community, to have found one's place in the Earth community, in the ecology of the world. So let me give a little perspective for this. When we're children, our identity is primarily in terms of our family. Think of ourselves as somebody's son or daughter. That's just how we understand who we are. In our place in the world. In adolescence, which begins in our early teens, we understand ourselves in a wider community sense, in terms of our peer group or in terms of our vocation or our social role. Another way to say that is we understand ourselves, our identity is cultural based. But for a true adult, my reading of what we find in cultural anthropology and healthy traditions and mythology, etc., is that a true adult understands his or her identity in terms of the place that he or she occupies or was born to occupy in the natural world. And that's something that might sound mysterious to a lot of our listeners are mystical, and it is essentially mysticism. So the idea here is that each of us was born to take a certain place in the greater ecology of the Earth community. And it takes a good deal of developmental success, a good deal of maturing, a lot of challenging times as we grow up to get to the place where we're even ready to ask that question, which it wouldn't even be a coherent question to a child or an adolescent. But that's what the initiation rites that we find in healthy traditions, and that we're just maybe beginning to get a glimpse of the possibility of a contemporary Western version of that. The initiation rites into adulthood involve a dying to everything we thought was true about ourselves in our adolescent stage. And there's a long period at the beginning of the initiation process, which takes many months or usually many years. It's a long period at the beginning where we just are dying to, we're surrendering our adolescent sense of ourselves. And then with a variety of initiatory practices, beginning to lift the veil of our cultural identity and begin to explore the mysteries of our own human psyche and the mysteries of the natural world. And there, if we're fortunate, after quite a bit of time of exploring the mysteries, we'll begin to get glimpses of our ecological identity, which is our soul, S-O-U-L, our soul identity. And the way our place in the Earth community appears to us, the way we experience that, is through essentially myth, which means sacred story. Doesn't mean something false, it means sacred story. And through poetry. And so many people call our mature identity, or our soul identity, our mythopoetic identity. It comes in terms to our consciousness in terms of metaphor, a nature metaphor. And so a mature person, a true adult, never understands themselves primarily in terms of a cultural role. For a true adult, it would be meaningless to say, my purpose in life is to, and then complete that sentence with a profession or a career or a craft or a job or a project or an art. That any answer like that would be a cultural answer. But the mystical, mythopoetic identity is it identifies our place in the natural world. I can give you examples later, but one of the first tasks of a person who has been initiated into true adulthood is to then discover or choose one or more delivery systems, cultural delivery systems, for their mythopoetic or ecological identity. And those delivery systems are what we call professions, jobs, crafts, disciplines, arts, and so forth. But the initiated adult understands that they're using that career or that project or that art as a way of delivering or manifesting their mythopoetic identity.
Well, there's a lot of the people that I know, Bill, that have gone through this kind of complete breakdown of what they thought they were, have gone through it because of some trauma, car accident, near-death experience, dissolution of their family, or even being thrown in jail. I mean, there's does it have to be that dramatic to move through that phase where everything you knew was wrong?
It does have to be really dramatic, I believe, but it doesn't have to be an accident. It doesn't have to be an accident or a tragedy or a travesty, like the examples you just gave. The reason in our culture that it's often an accident or a tragedy that leads us to begin to question our personal identity is because we've lost the initiation practices. We've lost the initiation wisdom that used by initiators, and also we don't have many true elders in our culture anymore. Maybe we'll be talking about that later in the hour. And what the in a healthy culture or a healthy context in our own culture, where there these genuine initiation into adulthood practices are used. In those contexts, the initiation facilitators, or the elders, use practices and methods that are absolutely as dramatic as a terrible, you know, physical accident or a loss of religious faith or a divorce or a loss of one's job or et cetera, all the terrible things that can shake us up. The methods are equally dramatic, but they're deliberate. And they're used with people who are developmentally ready to be able to benefit from those practices.
Well, most of us have heard of youth initiation, taking young men away from the house of their mother and taking them through some challenge or even painful experience that causes them to move from child into the realm of the adults. But you're talking about an initiation at a much later stage.
Yeah, and usually age too. I think the few little vignettes we have of some puberty rites from other cultures, they're really not relevant to contemporary Western people at all anymore. But I would say if we had anything like that, and puberty rites are so important for us to have, and there are some very progressive folks who are developing and have been for decades now, developing Western versions of puberty rites. But a puberty rite, at say roughly around age 13, this is a transition not into adulthood at all. It's a transition from childhood into adolescence.
Let's talk about your model, because I think it's so helpful. I have it in front of me. I wish we could put it up on a screen somewhere. But you talk about actually eight stages of the wheel of life. And I'll just name them, and then I want to ask you to go into some detail about them. So the eight stages go from birth all the way to death. And stage one is early childhood. Stage two is middle childhood. Stage three, early adolescence. Stage four, late adolescence. Stage five, early adulthood. Stage six, late adulthood. Stage 7, early elderhood, and stage 8, late elderhood, leading all the way to death. And so which of the stages are you talking about, and why is our culture seem to be so adolescent?
Great. Yeah, good question. First of all, if any of the listeners now or later want to see this map, which I call the soul-centric developmental wheel, they can find it on one of my websites, which is natureandthehumansoul.com. That's the name of my second book, natureandthehumansoul.com. And on that website, you have to surf through there a little bit, but you'll find the diagram. So yeah, there are these eight stages. I also have given them archetypal names that you'll see in the diagram. And
talk about the task and the center of gravity in particular, because those are significant to me. They really speak to me.
Oh, good.
What's the task of early childhood? And
good, yeah, it's helpful. Yeah, each of the eight stages, of these soul, what I call the soul-centric stages, which are not the stages that most people in our culture go through. In our culture, they go through ego-centric stages, and most of us do, and you can find that description in my book, too. But each of the soul-centric stages have two developmental tasks. One is a nature-oriented task, and the other is a culture-oriented task. And the center of gravity refers to how we understand our existence in the different stages. Kind of like what I was talking about before in terms of our identity. So, geez, Lion, we don't have that much time, so I won't say too much about early childhood. That's usually our first 3 years or so, and, of course, we don't have a task at all when we're that young. Our parents and families have the task on our behalf. And their task on our behalf is to preserve our innocence, which is our innate innocence, which is relates to our capacity for being present-centered here and now. And the second task has to do with to help us develop an ego that is healthy and viable and so on. And we don't really have a conscious identity at all in our first 3 or 4 years. Or you could say we have no identity, or you could say that our identity hasn't separated yet from spirit.
Sort of on record mode for those years, kind of recording everything around us.
Yeah, but not with self-consciousness yet, because that's what the development of conscious self-awareness is what brings us from stage one to stage two, which is stage two being middle childhood, or what I call the garden. So the task of that stage, the nature-oriented task, is the one that for hundreds of years we've had trouble with in the Western world, and that's led to developmental challenges later in life. The nature-oriented task in middle childhood, which children share with their parents or families, is to learn the enchantment of the natural world.
If we're separated from the natural world, by living in a house in a city with cement everywhere, and maybe one tree with a few spider webs in it, that's not really an environment to get that, is it?
Exactly, and we're mostly separated from the natural world just by our culture, our kind of nature denying culture. But part of the natural world is our own human nature. And if we can divide that into at least three things, that part of our human nature includes our emotions, which we don't choose, they're natural, and our imagination, which is natural, part of our human nature, and our own bodies. Those three things are our human nature. And getting to know those three realms, body, imagination, and emotions, are often suppressed or ignored in our culture. So our own human nature, we don't cultivate as much as we need to become fully human later in life. So by the time we get to adolescence, our teen years, we already have some developmental developmental failures in the first two stages because of the way our culture is designed and the way we're brought up in our educational systems and our mainstream religious systems and entertainment systems and so on. And so
you said this wasn't an ego development model, but by this time a child and then an adolescent usually has developed some kind of ego, some kind of self orientation,
yes.
They're usually spending a lot of time asserting that ego.
Yes, and trying to create an ego or personality that is both authentic and socially acceptable. And right there, that's the task of adolescence, which starts in our teen years. And for my guess is that for 80% of Westerners, no matter how long we live, we never get out of psychological early adolescence. It's a hard thing.
So much of the men's movement is about authenticity, and it takes a lot of work to find out who you are authentically or how to express yourself authentically. We're pretty good at finding the socially acceptable roles, but authenticity seems to evade us.
Again, because we don't put that much emphasis on it in our mainstream culture, and then we've had some difficulties in the first two stages, the stages of childhood, so that we don't have the personal resources that we need. We don't have as much of them as we need in order to succeed at the task of authenticity. So again, let me say a little bit more explicitly, the nature-oriented task of early adolescence, which starts in our teen years and may never end, no matter how long we live. The nature-oriented task is discovering who we are in an authentic way, developing our authenticity on a personality level, discovering our true values, our limits, our tolerances, our attitudes, our interests, our style, our sexuality, and so on, and our emotions, being able to tell what we're feeling and how to express them and how to deal with conflict and how to create a social world that works for us and the people who are in our social dramas with us. All that is part of authenticity. And the culture-oriented task of adolescence, early adolescence, is to create a personality that's not only authentic but socially acceptable, that works especially in our peer group.
You can be an authentic asshole, right, and be very authentic, but that's not very socially acceptable. Or you can be a socially acceptable introvert and
loner,
not actually have any authenticity.
Exactly. Either one's relatively easy. It's relatively easy to be totally authentic and have no friends, or to be the life of the party and everybody's favorite person and be a total fraud. Both are easy. And what we do in our mainstream Western culture is we put our emphasis on social acceptability and socioeconomic security and almost nothing on authenticity. And that's really the difference, the big difference between healthy adolescent masculinity and unhealthy or even pathological adolescent masculinity. The unhealthy masculinity has trouble with authenticity and puts the big emphasis on being socially acceptable by winning as much as possible, by being as wealthy as possible, by having the biggest version of whatever you're doing, by being the fastest, by bagging the most peaks, basically being greedy. That's what masculinity has come to mean in our culture, and it's a pathological version of masculinity.
We're so conditioned to that also. I mean, all of the conditioning and the programming and the media and the consumer society, it all directs us to those outward forms of what it means to have power, to be someone, to be famous, to be a celebrity, to be popular. It's a lot of programming to fight.
It's a lot. Boy, you said it. It's a lot of programming. It's not easy. And so when I say that I believe most Westerners, 80%, are still in psychological adolescence, it sounds like a terrible thing to say, and it sounds very critical, and I don't mean it that way at all. Partly because it's not our fault. It's our culture having been degraded for actually probably 5,000 years or more. And it's also the fact that healthy adolescence is a really great thing. If we had a healthy adolescent society, we wouldn't have hardly any of the problems we're having right now. Moving from egocentric or pathological adolescence to healthy adolescence is a big step. It makes all the difference in the world. It would save our planet and all the other species that we share this planet with if we could move to healthy adolescence quickly.
We actually care about ourselves and each other and the world, right?
Exactly. A healthy adolescent, man or woman, believes in partnership first, not domination. Domination is pathological. Healthy adolescence is partnership-oriented. It's power with. It's serving others, serving our community. That's healthy adolescence. So what I see happening in the men's movement in this country, which I haven't researched that carefully, but most of what I see is helping men really develop their authenticity in a deep way, develop their capacity for partnership and cooperation and serving the world. It's great. It's so essential. And this is kind of a difficult thing to say, it's not an initiation into true adulthood, which is a different thing as I understand it. It's, as I say, it's mystical and nature-oriented and soul-oriented on a level much deeper than the personality.
Well, I would agree with you that most of the men's groups I know spend time in that authenticity, maturing the pathological adolescent into the mature adolescent. But I also know a lot of men's groups that go much deeper than that. The tribe of men that I'm part of has initiatory processes to take us deeper into our soul and into our spiritual self. So I think there's some hope out there for the men's movement, because
yes.
I guess we do have to catch up first. We have to sort of clean up the past before we can move into the next stage. At least
clean up the past, develop our authenticity, our capacity with emotions and conflict resolution, and developing a social presence and developing an ecological consciousness. Just being very aware of where everything that feeds our lives comes from and how we can learn to serve the greater Earth community. So there is a lot of, cultural and individual catch-up work to do, absolutely.
So what's the next stage then? Once you get your authenticity and your social acceptability and your partnership together and you know your values and you understand your interests and you can deal with conflict and all those great things, you've got all that together. Now what? Aren't I done?
Yeah, you'd think maybe you were done. So the next passage or initiation is one I call confirmation. So I'll just back up here just for a moment to say my understanding is actually 9 initiations in life, not one. birth is the first and death is the last. And puberty is the third. And a fourth one is what I call a confirmation. And each initiation, each passage requires a long initiation process. Essentially, the entire developmental stage, whichever one we're in, is an initiatory process leading to this passage at the end. So this one you just asked about, Lion, is I call confirmation. It's the one passage after puberty. And what's being confirmed there, not by elders, but by the mystery. The mystery is, or the soul, you might say, is confirming that you've developed an early adolescent personality well enough that you don't need to polish it and accessorize it any further, that you've learned how to create a personal presence in the world. And as soon as you create and finish that adolescent house of belonging, it's time to walk right out the door. And when there are true elders or initiation facilitators in a culture, they've been watching you. They've been watching you beginning to show signs of having completed the adolescent personality, early adolescent personality. They see that maybe if when you're courting somebody romantically that you've gotten much more eloquent than you ever had before. They see that you're asking questions about what is myth, what is death, what is true education, why does our consciousness shift so deeply? What is poetry and what is metaphor? And when they see things like this, they whisk you away and begin to help you die psychologically to who you thought you were. And this is a process of many months or years. It's just this first part, this dying. It's not something that happens in a week or a five-day program or 10-day. It's a long process. And they also...
I can see my reaction to that is going, hey, I just got all my shit together. Now you want me to give it up?
That's exactly how it feels. Exactly. That's it. And we're just, and the elders are there waiting for us and saying, now it's time to remove yourself from everyday village consciousness, and maybe actually from the village too for weeks or months on end. Because the village, the culture is just going to keep reminding you who you already have been. So we move into this stage, the fourth stage in my model, and I call it the cocoon. And so everyone knows what that implies, that the caterpillar, which is the adolescent, moves into a place away from everyday life and begins to die to caterpillarhood. And inside the cocoon, the caterpillar just becomes actually liquid soup. And there are these cells, these imago cells that biologists call them. And the imago cells begin to take all those caterpillar cells, which are now liquid, and reassemble them into the body of an adult. But the caterpillar has to die first. And so during the tasks of the cocoon stage, there are two. I've been speaking about both of them indirectly. One is a dying, and the other one is a being reborn. Or you could say the first stage, first task is a goodbye. And the second task is a hello. The goodbye is to our adolescent personality and social world. And the hello is to the mysteries of nature and psyche. And by exploring those mysteries through a great variety of practices, at Animus Valley Institute we use about 20 or 30 different kinds of practices, most of them found in healthy cultures around the world, but we've been crafting contemporary Western versions of them. We use these practices to explore the mysteries of our place in the world, our individual, unique place in the world. And with good fortune, one day we begin to glimpse our mythopoetic identity in terms of our place in the natural world.
This reminds me of the Celtic mystery schools that have been around for eons, and also in the Hindu tradition where you become a householder, you raise a family, and then at some point you get to go and do your spiritual path, and go study with a master or become a monk or a sadhu. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
I think probably similarities, but there's a lot of differences there too. In a healthy culture, one would always go through the soul initiation process, the cocoon, what I call the cocoon stage, before one marries or has children or is a householder. But ideally, our children are raised by initiated adult parents. And that, of course, is rare in our culture. The other thing about the that Hindu model you mentioned is that that spiritual seeking after the householder phase is not a downward descent into the underworld of soul. It's an upper world ascent into the mysteries of spirit. So this has been one of the biggest rediscoveries I've had in my life. I say rediscovery because I obviously didn't invent this. And we don't find it in our mainstream world, and we don't find it in any of our avant-garde transpersonal psychologies and spiritualities in our Western culture these days. Namely, that spirituality actually has two parts, two poles, two components, and they're opposite in some way, but they're not in conflict with one another, and true spirituality always combines both, not just one. And what I'm referring to is the upper path towards the light, or towards our universal resonance with all of life or all of the universe, or non-dual consciousness. And the other half of spirituality is into the sacred dark. We descend to go there. It's not into hell, it's into the sacred underworld, to find what is most unique about us. And in our contemporary progressive spiritual worlds, with all the emphasis is all on going up to our universal understanding of how our existence is resonant.
It's the oneness path, right? The non-dual.
Yeah, exactly.
Achieving
the oneness. Which is essential, understanding how we're brothers and sisters, fellow beings, and with all the life forms on this planet, at least. So it's the universal path, right? And the downward path is towards our uniqueness, but not our personality uniqueness. And not, some people think, in the spiritual domains, they think the downward path is about like doing shadow work, where we discover hidden parts of our personality that are not so savory. And that's actually not underworld at all. That's middle world psychotherapy, which is so important. The underworld, I'm not talking about shadow. I'm talking about the mysteries of our soul, of our unique identity. And that kind of darkness is not dark in the sense of unsavory or antisocial or anything like that. It's dark in the sense of just hidden, of mysterious. And so even in the most progressive spiritual context, it's still rare to understand the distinction between the underworld and soul discovery on one hand, and the middle world psychotherapy or healing on the other, both of which...
You're making quite a few important distinctions. You're distinguishing...
I try.
Yeah. Not easy. It's not an easy model to follow, but it's fascinating to me because it's you're dividing up the personality growth from soul growth or soul maturing. You're dividing up the nature-based... From the soul-based, or those seem to be very intimately tied.
Both are intimately, yeah, tied.
And the psychological processing from the soul discovery. So I'm kind of fascinated and terrified at the same time by looking at the model and going, wow, it's like, you know, I'm trying to place myself on your map, and it feels like I could be throwing darts, you know, to say, there's where I am on the body, and there's where I am on the maturity, and there's where I am on the psychological.
Well, here's one thing that will help, and this is found in traditions all over the world. This is a very, very common thing I'm about to mention, and that is that in some ways it's said that there are three worlds, and these aren't three different places. These are actually three, you might say, levels of consciousness, or three kinds of identity that every person has. And it's simply upper world, middle world, underworld, or lower world. We find this in spiritual teachings all over the world. So let's just think in terms of identity. Our middle world identity is our social identity, including, you know, who we are in our personal relationships and our family and our what kind of job or profession we have, who we are in our culture. That's our middle world identity. Our underworld identity, or lower world, is who we are relative to the earth community, our ecological identity, our mythopoetic, or our soul identity. And that's completely different than our personality and our middle world identity. And then the upper world identity is something that everybody and everything shares in common. It's our universal coexistence with the vast consciousness, the imagination of the world, the whole earth community, that our oneness with all things. So everybody, each person has three identities, and you could say sometimes it's spoken of as three different worlds. And part of developing is to develop each one of those three identities. And the upper world and the underworld together are what, in our culture, we call spirituality.
Well, we have so many more stages to go and not a lot of time. So give us a sense of where this goes from the cocoon. What happens next?
Yeah, okay, great. During the cocoon, at some point, we do get glimpses of our ecological identity. Comes in metaphor or myth or poetry. And or you could say nature mirroring to us who we are metaphorically. And I call that experience one of soul encounter. And at some point, the mystery essentially says you've glimpsed enough about your soul identity to begin to embody it in your world for your people. And that's the moment of soul initiation, the passage where we go from late adolescence into early adulthood.
So it's not just the personal now, it's moved into something for the community, the greater
exactly.
than itself.
Exactly. So in early adolescence, our life was all about culture, a peer group, really about sex and society. And in the cocoon, the fourth stage, late adolescence, we withdraw from culture and really go off into both the inner and the outer wilderness. And then we return to culture as a true adult, but now we understand ourselves in terms of our ecological identity. And you might say we become transcultural. All true adults are transcultural, which means we still function through a cultural identity and in a culture among our people, but our first and foremost way we understand ourselves, our identity, is not cultural, it's ecological.
And then where a person might suddenly feel like they're a steward for the earth, or all children are their children, and they start caring for something beyond themselves, or they're a tribe or clan. Is that right?
Yeah. I have lots of examples in both my books, but it's probably always most fair to give an example from myself. Up until I was about 30, I understood myself as, you know, the son of my parents and the intimate partner to a woman and a friend to various people. And professionally, I was a psychologist, research psychologist, and a clinical psychologist. And I served my people through the arts of psychotherapy. But after my early 30s, I understood myself the way that nature showed me to understand myself. And these are not easy or simple things to explain briefly. But one of the key parts, and I've written about this in both my books, key parts of my first vision fast experience, was that the natural world showed me that my life on a deeper level was going to be about learning to weave cocoons of transformation for my people, which are essentially to learn how to facilitate the initiatory process that happens during that fourth stage of life, which I ended up calling the cocoon for obvious reasons. I was shown by a butterfly and a spruce tree that my place in the world was of someone who weaves cocoons. So starting in early adulthood, that's how I understood what I was doing. And whatever cultural context I used to do it, it was a means to an end, a delivery system. And I've used a number of delivery systems, including that of psychotherapy and a vision fast guide, ceremonialist, writer, author, speaker, and so on. But what I'm thinking I'm doing, the way I understand what I'm doing at all times is weaving cocoons.
So I think of myself in this model that you're talking about. I keep trying to peg myself, and I realize, well, part of me is thinking about the world and the ecology and all the children. It's very, very dear to me to think, you know, what can I do to make the lives of all of our children better? And yet part of me is still in an identity of being a businessman or a coach or a therapist. Part of me is, you know, has a job and I'm a householder. So I seem to be sort of spread out over a good part of your map. It's not just a single phase at a time, is it, or is it? And I'm just missing something.
Well, it's a really good question. And when one constructs a map or a template, you have to make some decisions about how you're going to talk about things. And it's been really clear for me from the beginning that it's really important in a model like this, which we find, by the way, in other kinds of developmental models too, that in fact, no, we're only in one stage at a time.
Oh, no.
Which is to say our center of gravity is only in one place.
I knew it. There was something wrong with me all along. I always do that.
Now, we can work on the task. We can address the developmental task of our current stage and all of the stages preceding the one we're in. But I believe it's not psychologically possible to really address the tasks of the stages beyond the one we're in. So, and nobody ever completes the developmental tasks of any stage. We just do as best as we can, and sometimes the mystery says that's enough, we're moving you on. But part of maturing in any stage is to be giving some attention to the least complete developmental task of our earlier stages.
Okay, well, take us beyond the cocoon stage. What happens after that? You come back out into the culture, into your tribe or your civilization,
yep.
And you recognize that I can take something I've learned and now make a contribution back to others.
Yeah, it's early adulthood, which I call the soul apprentice. And that's when the main task there is to learn one or more delivery systems for your soul gift, one or more delivery systems that already exist in the culture. And so you study with a master in one or more delivery systems. For example, I studied with quite a number of people in my early adulthood, including Stephen Foster and Meredith Little, the School of Lost Borders in California, learning from them the delivery system of the contemporary vision fast. And I've studied with a number of other teachers as well.
I became a coach and have studied with my masters like Hal Stone and Tim Kelly and many of the other people that we've had on this program. But
yes.
What's the next step? What's the next
step? Next step, at some point, again, the mystery just shakes us right down to our core. That happens at the end of every stage. Every stage is a crisis. Beginning of every stage is a difficult challenge. The end of early adulthood, the crisis is that we thought it would never happen, but one day we realize that the delivery system or systems I've learned from my beloved teachers are no longer going to take me the next step. Can't rest on their accomplishments any further. That we realize that what I have to do next is something that's never been done before, and I don't know what it is. But I have to create my own never-before-seen delivery system for the passions of my own soul, to bring my own soul gifts into the world, to manifest my ecological identity. And it's going to feel like I'm betraying my teachers. And I'm going to feel like I'm making a complete, ridiculous fool out of myself. And I'm going to probably be laughed out of everything. That's the crisis. And I'm trying to think what I call that.
The artisan in the wild orchard.
Yeah, the passage is, well, I've lost it here, but it's induction. It's called induction. Induction into our artistry, to the artisan stage. Because this late adulthood, as you say, Lion, I call the artisan in the wild orchard. Because in a wild orchard, you know, every tree creates its own unique fruit. It's only through you know, grafting and so on, that we get the same apple out of millions of trees. But in a wild orchard, every apple is unique. So that's the task of late adulthood, is to create our innovative delivery systems. And at some point, at the end of that stage, there's a crisis, and that is we realize that our life for so many years, our both adult stages, has been about bringing our unique gift into the world, and we thought our whole life would be about that. But then we realize, and I have not gone through this transition, so I'm relying on stories and teachings from my elders. They say we reach a stage where, I mean, a point where it's not about our own soul work anymore, that our task then becomes caring for the soul of the more than human community. That's what's most important as an elder. And we need elders, of course, because the adults, the true adults, are busy bringing their particular unique soul path into the world. But we need elders who are able to, among other things, keep the balance good between the human community and the greater earth community. If there aren't true elders keeping that balance good, then things get out of whack. And
the final stage is late elderhood. So say a few words about that. And I want to take some questions from the audience.
That's so mystical. It's very hard to talk about. But in a sense, we become one with the universe. We have no more tasks. And we just are in a state of being, which in some ways makes the universe in you. And if you really want to hear about that, the best thing would be to take a look at my book, Nature and the Human Soul. It's a very mystical stage. It's hard to articulate and briefly.
Well, let me just suggest that the people go to your website, animas.org, that's animas.org, and if you would like to be on Bill's mailing list, press 1 now, and we'll hand your emails over to him. If you're on the webcast, you can type in your email address, and we'll grab your email as well. Type in your email address and send it as a question. So you provide soul-based initiations, wilderness trips, and deep inquiries into this process, and you've done it for thousands of people, and you do it pretty much everywhere across the U.S., don't you?
Pretty much, and we've been in Europe quite a bit as well.
So you can find out more at Animas, A-N-I-M-A-S.org.
Yeah, that's, by the way, that's the Spanish word. It's plural for souls. Be better pronounced. I don't pronounce it well myself, but it's animas. A-N-I-M-A-S. It's not the Jungian word animus, which means essentially the masculine inside of a woman. It's souls. Yeah, animas.
And then you said you had another website where people could get this Wheel of Life map. Would you say that one again?
Yeah, that's the title of my second book, Nature and the Human Soul .com.
Great. So if you have a question for Bill Plotkin, you can type it in if you're on the webcast, or you can raise your hand by pressing 1 on your phone, and we can continue this rich conversation. We need to end in about 5 minutes, but let's see if we can get one or two questions in at least. And let's see, we have questions. Someone from who called in on the general pin, say your name and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Reza. So I'm a young guy. I'm actually 19, turning 20 in a month. And I love the conversation about initiation, and I've done some self-development work, and I really think that kind of moves me to give to men too, and I want to give that to myself. And you were talking about how we don't usually transform into manhood or change or transform unless something really dramatic happens, and I haven't really had that, and I feel like I'm in boyhood and adolescence, and I want to go into manhood. So where I'm specifically at is, like, I came from being a little too cocky to being a little too nice, and that's where I feel like I'm at now, and I'm carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders. And, you know, I want to go into manhood and have balance. So how can I do that? How can I create some dramatic moment?
Yeah, Bill, are your programs good for people in their 20s, or are they mostly dedicated to the later stages of maturing?
Well, we want to contrast stage and age, because the model I've developed is not age-oriented at all. There's no guarantee that any given age will move to a next stage. But yes, we do have people in their 20s, even early 20s, even late teens sometimes. I believe that in a healthy, contemporary culture or cultural context, which we are a long, long ways from, but in such a context, most people would move into the cocoon stage in their mid to late teens. And in our culture, most people never move into the cocoon stage, but those who do usually do in their late 20s to late 60s, somewhere in that range. That in the late 20s is something very interesting that happens that astrologers know about, are the first Saturn return, and that really shakes things up. So many people listening to this who are in their late 20s or later, you'll remember. You'll remember if you're older than your late 20s, what happened in your late 20s, 27, 28, 29, or 30. Probably things shook up and there was an opening there to the mysteries. And if you didn't have any initiators or elders to help you, you might just have missed the window. It just closed after a while, and maybe you'll get another one. Usually in early 40s, we often get one. It's called a midlife crisis, when we're about as close to dying as we are to having been born, and we start asking those big questions again.
Yeah, I had mine when I was 26, and I had a person shoot me in the head four times. So
right.
I don't recommend that necessarily as a right
no.
of for other people.
You don't want to line up for that.
Not necessarily. We have a question from Gerald. Gerald, oops, just one second. Gerald, go ahead, Gerald. You have a question for Bill?
Yeah, so I'm at the other end of the age spectrum, being I'm 74 at this time, and I've puzzled about what has mainly contributed to our disconnection with nature or our separation from nature. And I was wondering, to what degree do you think that language and technology have played major roles in this? And I sort of see the challenge becomes for if you're born into, or as a child you're connected to nature, the challenge then becomes how to reconnect with nature. And I agree that, like in my case, it did take a crisis thing and it brought it around. But what role do language and technology play in this disconnect?
Well, that's a big question.
No.
It's probably not language itself, it's or any particular language, but the way we use our language is very much part of our culture, and culture of our, like ours, which is very nature alienated. We use language in a way that ignores or even disses nature. Many of the idioms and metaphors we use are kind of nature negative, and we tend to, because of that, we tend to see nature as a dangerous place that's out to eat us and so on.
And the Romance languages are also noun-oriented. They're very thing-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
They thingify or reify pretty much everything, whereas other languages are more process-oriented or experientially oriented, right?
Yep. A lot of people say that's a big problem, too. Technology, again, I don't think technology itself is a problem at all, but the way we use technology in our mainstream Western culture is it's a big distraction. It alienates us from the real world, which is the natural world. And a healthy human culture is very much part of that natural world. So, the way we use language and technology are symptoms of our nature-alienated culture is what I would say briefly.
And if you read the history of civilization, there was a point at which we started building walls around cities, and that cut us off from nature. It was meant to protect, but it also cut us off from the natural world in a big way. So, Bill, I know you have to go at the top of the hour. I want to invite people to stay on the line because in just a few minutes we have Stephen Dynan interviewing Dan Millman, the author of The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and that's from 6 to 7 o'clock. It's going to be a fabulous program to end our day today. And Bill, I want to thank you so much for being here and for going over this deep and profound map of our soul and our soul's maturities. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lion. It's been my pleasure entirely. Thank you so much. It was a great opportunity, and I hope it stirs up the right kind of trouble with the people listening to this.
Yes, that I love that quote. I heard it from Michael Mead.
That's where I got it to.
Yeah, young people will always get into trouble, and it's the responsibility of the elders to get them into the right kind of trouble. And if they
exactly.
they're not initiated, they'll get into the wrong kind of trouble. So
yes.
may we all get into the right kind of trouble. And Bill, I wish you a good evening. I
thank you
so much. And for all of you listening, thank you for being here. Feel free to continue the conversation on our Facebook page, theshiftnetwork.com. And we're going to say goodbye, but in a few minutes, if you hold on to the line, you'll hear Stephen Dynan interviewing Dan Millman. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye now.